AFP Audio is today talking to Philip Mitchell, who is the author of an article in the September 2013 edition on bipolar disorder. Welcome, Philip.
Thanks very much, Carolyn.
So, Philip Mitchell is the Scientia Professor and Head of School of Psychiatry at the University of New South Wales and Director of the Bipolar Disorders Clinic at the Black Dog Institute. And as I said, in the September 2013 edition, he's authored an article on bipolar disorder. And that starts by making the point that patients with bipolar disorder present both a major opportunity and major challenge for the general practitioner. Why is this?
I deliberately put those both in together because they're very true. So the major opportunity is that when the treatment works, it can just make such a huge difference to people's lives. Bipolar disorder is my main clinical interest as well as my main research interest. I also treat people with other conditions, other mental illnesses, and it struck me that when you get the mix of medications and psychological treatment and support right, you can just change people's lives around so dramatically. It may be not a complete response, but even, you know, a major change in stability of the illness allows people to resume relationships, to contribute to their family, to be able to have a meaningful vocation, to be able to earn, you know, sufficient money to enable them at least to have their, you know, their basic needs met. So good treatment can just shift people's lives something dramatic. The challenge is that poorly controlled bipolar disorder causes chaos and difficulty all round. For the families, this is very difficult, you know, particularly manic episodes, that people are very different to their normal selves. They're often more irritable, aggressive, sarcastic. They may be doing things quite out of character, and they've got no insight. So the family's perturbed. It causes, you know, trauma and chaos within the family, that people who are highly reliable, you know, become disorganized. You know, for the GP, they're going to get frequent phone calls. The patient may be ringing them, you know, with out of character concerns or complaints. So mania is chaotic. And I think that's sort of one of the difficulties. If someone's poorly controlled, it impinges upon, as well as the GP, family and friends. So, you know, both are possible and both are the realities of bipolar.
Yeah, and as you said, there are opportunities, but it also can be quite disabling. And about 1% of the population suffers from bipolar. When a patient presents to you, how do you go about making the diagnosis of bipolar disorder?
Well, the usual reason for presentation is not mania. So we're talking, unless they're being brought in by, you know, a family member who's concerned. So when the person themselves is presenting, it's usually depression. So when you're doing your normal checklist for depression, I think it's always important to be looking at the presence of past manic or hypomanic episodes. So you're looking for periods that are distinctly different from this person's normal functioning. You've got to be careful you're not confusing personality with episodes of mania. So we're not talking here, you know, about someone who, when they're not depressed, is a successful businessman with a lot of energy and drive, which is their basic nature. You're looking for episodes which are a distinct discontinuity with that person's normal personality, you know, so that the energy, you know, is elevated, people aren't needing as much sleep. You know, they're becoming perhaps much more sociable or doing things out of character, like spending more, getting involved in relationships they normally wouldn't, perhaps being much more frank than usual, and a heightened activity. So, it's a change, a discontinuity from the person's normal functioning. And that's in addition to the depression, which is the most common reason they're seeing you in the first place.
And as you point out, depression is the most common sort of presentation. Are there some features that might make us particularly a bit more suspicious and look further for those changed sort of features that are more common in bipolar depression than in unipolar depression?
This is an issue which has really intrigued me over the last 10 years, and we've been doing a lot of work in this area. And if you'd asked people around the world 10 or 15 years ago, people would have said there's no difference. But the work coming about out of our group and others, and this is both in Caucasian as well as Asian and other communities, is that there do appear to be some substantial differences. It's not to the point where you can say with diagnostic certainty when you see someone, this is bipolar depression compared to unipolar depression. We talk about a probabilistic approach. So it's more if there's certain features, they suggest to you there's a higher likelihood that this may be bipolar. So what are the features that we see? One of the striking ones is excess, increased sleep compared to the decreased sleep that you see in most patients with depression. I have changed the way I ask about sleep. I now say over 24 hours, how many hours do you sleep when you're depressed if you add together daytime and nighttime? And what you very commonly see with bipolar patients is they say to you, I normally sleep 7 to 9, but when I'm depressed, I sleep 12, 14, 16, even 18 hours a day. When I first saw this, I thought it was a medication effect, but there's no doubt that this is part of the depression. Some people eat more rather than eat less. One of the other striking features is people are slowed down. In technical terms, they've got psychomotor retardation, and that may vary from subtle slowing through to quite profound slowing. They're also more likely to show some of the sort of typical melancholic features like waking early in the morning, a diurnal mood variation where they're worse in the morning. They occasionally or rarely may have psychotic features. That's a small minority of patients. Other features that you see are there's some interspersal of subtle manic or hypomanic features, and we call this a mixed presentation. Some of the other features that we see are the course of the illness. So it's an earlier presentation. Typically, the depressions are beginning before the age of 25. And also they're having more depressive episodes. And we arbitrarily think of 5 or more, but it is in general, it's more depression. And the other feature that we look at is that there's often a family history of bipolar disorder. So there's sort of this mix of features. And it's really quite an interesting presentation. I think there's a gradual acceptance that there is a difference between bipolar and unipolar depression.
Yep. So once the diagnosis has been made of bipolar disorder, we move on to management. And I'll make the point that what might be TGA approved may not be PBS subsidised for all cases. So I would urge listeners to actually have a look and double check whatever their proposed management is planning to be. But in general terms, what are the sort of most efficacious treatments for the acute treatment of mania?
Well, if we look at the treatment of mania, I think there's been a shift in how we think about the acute management. Historically, we would have said, and certainly in my own writings, I would have said a number of years ago that lithium and other historic mood stabilizers like Epilum or Valproate are medications that we use first. The growing evidence now is that the most effective treatments for containing acute mania are the antipsychotics. Those other medications I mentioned, lithium and valproate, are still effective. There's no doubt about that. But if you look at the potency of effect, that the ability to substantially reduce manic symptoms, there's now been some very prominent meta-analyses indicating that the most effective treatments are the antipsychotics. Now, most of those that have been studied in mania are the newer or atypical antipsychotics. But included in the list of antipsychotics is one of the older ones, haloperidol. So I think we think of antipsychotics in general being the most effective treatment. In practice, we tend to use the newer, the atypical antipsychotics. And amongst those, the ones that stand out as being particularly effective are olanzapine and risperidone. Obviously, with a medication like olanzapine, you need to be careful of the potential for weight gain and metabolic syndrome. But if you look at what's most effective, it's the antipsychotics. And then after that, we would look at some of the historic mood stabilizers.
Yep. And so the article then makes the point that the acute treatment of bipolar depression is one of the more contentious management issues. What is the debate and why is the management contentious? And what do you think?
Okay. The treatment of bipolar depression has been one of the most significantly and emotionally contested areas in the management of bipolar disorder. If you look at the evidence, so-called evidence-based therapeutic guidelines from different countries around the world, this is the one area in the management of bipolar where there's substantial difference. The treatment of mania is pretty consistent. the preventive treatment of bipolar disorder is pretty consistent, but the treatment of bipolar depression differs. So what's the main issue? The main issue here is the role of antidepressants. That there are some leaders in the field, particularly in the US and some from Europe, who contest very strongly that antidepressants should never be used. They say they're not effective and are very likely to trigger off manic episodes or a rapid cycling presentation. Rapid cycling is where you're having a lot of episodes, and threshold is considered usually four or more episodes in a 12-month period. So they would contend that some would contend that it's almost negligent to use antidepressants. My opinion is that it's clear that the evidence is mixed. There's been some major studies saying the antidepressants work, a big meta-analysis a number of years ago saying they work in bipolar depression. But there was a big US study published in the New England Journal of Medicine said that found that antidepressants were no more effective than placebo. So that the clinician is left with this inconsistent evidence on which to make decisions. And I'm sure that's the reason that the guidelines have differed. My own opinion is that they work, and also that the chance of them triggering off manic or episodes or rapid cycling is actually much less than many would contend. And I would state that if you're going to use an antidepressant, it should be in conjunction with a mood stabilizer or an antipsychotic. Otherwise, you do risk patients being triggered off into mania or rapid cycling. It's interesting, just in the last few weeks since I wrote the article for Australian Family Physician, that there's been a publication from an international task force that asked international experts, based on the evidence, what would they recommend? And this was 65 experts from around the world, and there were a few from Australia, including myself, and this will be published soon in the American Journal of Psychiatry. And that international task force stated that there was a role for antidepressants, as long as you were judicious in the use of those, that you wouldn't use them in patients that were prone to becoming manic, but if you use them in conjunction with mood stabilizers, they tended to be a safer treatment than had been proposed by many. So it's interesting. My own bias has been that there's a role, as long as you're being careful, and this international task force is saying the same thing. So I think it's going to be very interesting when that's published in the next few months.
Yeah, and thinking, I mean, when we think of bipolar, lithium has been the mainstay of prevention of recurrences for many years. What's its role now, and are there other medications that may fulfill part of that role in the future?
Lithium has had its evidence increase as the years have gone on. And if you said, what's the gold standard or the benchmark treatment for prevention of episodes in bipolar, lithium would be up there as that which has the most evidence. So I think the evidence for lithium has grown rather than diminished with the years. I think there's a few caveats around that. It's becoming increasingly clear that lithium is much better for prevention of mania than it is for depressive episodes. It's interesting, for a number of medications, that's now becoming apparent, also for many of the atypical antipsychotics. So lithium is very clearly effective for preventing manic episodes, and this coincides with my clinical experience as well. I think that you often get a much cleaner prophylactic or preventive effect from lithium than you do for other agents. It's not as effective for the depressions, as I was saying. So that's when you're going to be thinking about the potential for other agents, maybe adding them to lithium. One of the agents which has been shown to be effective for preventing depressed episodes is lamotrigine. That's the evidence for that is strong. There's somewhat of a dilemma there because it's never been subsidised for bipolar depression prevention in Australia. It's certainly been approved. And recently, a generic manufacturer has publicised this, but it's still not subsidised on the PBS. So I think that's a problem for patients of limited financial means. But my own clinical experience is that for patients who have depressive episodes despite being on a drug like lithium, that lamotrigine can be very effective for helping control the depressive episodes. So lithium is still an excellent drug, and I use it commonly. And I think there's a resurgence of interest around the world for lithium. There was a recent publication in The Lancet that compared lithium with valproate, and that found that on a number of measures, lithium was superior to valproate. So I think we can now have some confidence that while lithium's an old drug, it's a good one. The only thing we need to be careful of, or the main thing we need to be careful of, is making sure there's no development of renal impairment. I think that there's growing evidence for that. It's probably not as common as was thought a number of years ago. But for many patients, if they develop renal impairment, it's only mild. In that situation, I refer to a renal physician for advice about whether it's safe to continue lithium. But for mild renal impairment, as long as you're monitoring renal function carefully and the patient's done very well on lithium, I think that can be continued as long as you're careful in your prescribing and monitoring.
Yep. Okay, so we've sort of talked our way through the medications in particular for different elements of bipolar disorder. In the past, psychological therapies might have been forgotten. What is their role thought to be now, and what sort of therapies might be of assistance?
We're increasingly considering that the best treatment for bipolar disorder is a mix of medications and psychological treatments. The psychological treatment doesn't have to be ongoing. It may be just at a period of time in which the patient learns particular skills. Now, what sorts of psychological treatment have been shown to be effective? In fact, it's fair to say that a number of different forms have been shown to be beneficial. Probably the main ones that are used are cognitive behaviour therapy and psychoeducation, which is a structured technique for informing the patient and helping them to understand their condition. In practice, there's a lot of overlap in the treatments that are offered between cognitive behaviour therapy and psychoeducation. So often they're both offered within the same package anyway. What are some of the things that happen with those treatments? I think one of the particularly useful things is patients becoming aware of triggers for episodes. So we know that as well as depressive episodes being precipitated by stress, that also manic episodes may be. So helping the patient identify, repeated triggers so that they can somehow deal with those or diminish the effect of those stresses. Another useful technique in the psychological treatment is patients becoming aware of early warning signs. And this is particularly useful for mania. So many patients will say to you in the days or weeks leading up to their clear manic episode, they notice they're not sleeping as much, don't need as much sleep. They might notice subtle increases in their energy. And other patients will describe other patterns that are sort of like partial, sub-threshold presentations. And what we know is if you can get in there early and treat that, so that may be the patient learning some psychological skills for dealing with that, or it might be something simple like giving the patient a medication to help them sleep better. But there's good evidence that you can actually terminate the episodes using those techniques before they develop into the full-blown picture. So these are some of the things that can be quite useful. So it's sort of skills-based psychological treatment. It's not sort of Freudian on the couch type psychological treatment. It's more teaching the patient sort of very practical skills that can help them control their bipolar better.
Excellent. And so, in summary, what are a few key points about bipolar disorder for GPs to remember when they're in their practice?
What are the messages for the GP? You won't see that many patients with bipolar, but I think there's a lot that you can do for individuals. I think the first is to maintain a therapeutic optimism, because for many patients, and I think this is usually done best in conjunction with some mental health specialist, either through a private psychiatrist or the local mental health team, that you can actually turn around the lives for many people. You also need those relationships with those professions, because when things become chaotic, it's very difficult in a general practice situation for you as an individual to contain that. You need good working relations, for example, with the local community mental health team. I think another message is don't stigmatise patients. I think despite the fact that we all are now accepting that these are legitimate health conditions, I think we find that we can easily become discriminatory or pejorative. I think it's important to treat people humanely, to treat them as well as we would, you know, with a person with diabetes or cancer, whatever. I think one of the things that I failed to mention before is that people with bipolar die earlier. We now know people are dying about 8 to 9 years earlier than other people in the community, from mainly from physical illness as well as suicide. So what this means is, as well as treating their mental illness well, we need to make sure we're doing a good job in terms of treating their physical illness. You know, it means their vascular disease, cardiovascular, cerebrovascular, helping them stop smoking as much as we can, or getting them into, you know, a smoking clinic or a smoking reduction program. So I think there's a lot of things the GP can do that are really beneficial for patients with bipolar.
Excellent. Well, thank you for speaking to us today. We've been talking to Professor Philip Mitchell about the article on bipolar disorder in the September 2013 edition of Australian Family Physician. Thank you.
My pleasure.